This is an oral history project of the Appellate Practice Section of the Florida Bar. Through interviews with members, we hope to record and preserve the history of the Appellate Practice Section. Here is your host, Dwayne Diker.
In this installment of the APS Oral History Project, I'm joined by Appellate Specialist Matt Canigliaro. Matt served, in fact, as an officer of the APS longer than any other person in the history of the section, which I think we'll talk about. Matt also served as the 18th chair of the section in the 2011 to 2012 bar year. Matt, thanks for joining me to help preserve some of the section's history by talking with the folks who were actually there.
Well, thanks, Dwayne. Happy to be here and be part of this.
So how did you originally get involved in the section? What are your first memories of your involvement with the APS?
After I'd been practicing for a few years and I had joined the section but had never gone to any events, the then current section chair had sent a letter around to section members, basically saying, the original generation of leaders have kind of worked their way through this organization. And we're encouraging new blood to start showing up at meetings and to get active and participate. And I took that and thought, well, I can go to a meeting. So the next time there was a bar meeting, I just started showing up. And I saw some people I knew. Not too many, but some that I knew. And one person that I knew was Shannon Carlisle. And Shannon and I had both been clerks at the 50CA at the same time back in the mid-90s. And Shannon was really nice to me. And if I remember right, she was on the EC at the time. And in either way, after I went to a handful of meetings, maybe over the course of a year or so, she urged me to try to just get on the EC. And so I think she put my name in, and next thing you knew, I was on it. And that gave me really good reasons to start going to meetings. And the group was much smaller than it sort of has become over the years. But it was fun. And that was my early sort of entree into it all. Prior to that, I guess I went to CLE committee meetings and some fairly uncontroversial things, and just kind of low level involvement. And then I found myself on the EC, and from there just wanted to get more and more involved. So I did, and the appellate section proved to be a great place where the more you wanted to be involved, there were things to be done. So I started getting involved with putting on CLEs, organizing them, inventing them. That was kind of fun. And otherwise just being active with whatever the events were that we had going on.
So in the beginning, I teased the fact that you have spent more time as an officer of the section than anyone else. And there were two different circumstances, I think, that led to that. Can you talk about why you?
It's just fate and happenstance, but that'll probably be true for a while till some strange thing happens to the next person. But when I became an officer, we had five officer positions. So there was a chair, chair-elect, vice chair, secretary, and treasurer. And when you began as treasurer and moved up from there. So there were five spots. And right in the year that I became an officer, we had made the change to eliminate the separate secretary and treasurer positions and combine them as a single position. So my first year as an officer, I was the treasurer. And my second year, I was the secretary treasurer. And then after, I guess it was my third year or going into the fourth year, was when Raul Cantero retired from the Florida Supreme Court. And before he went on the bench at the Supreme Court, he had been the chair-elect, I think, or maybe vice chair, one of those, of the section. And he left the section appropriately so, when he joined the court in charge of the entire bar. And I should say left the section. He left the leadership when he became a justice. And when he retired, the section and the officers agreed to offer him the opportunity to slip right back in where he was, which meant everybody, he came in as chair-elect, everybody below that froze. So I was, I guess it was vice chair, was probably the office at the time. And so I stayed as vice chair for 2 years and then became chair-elect and then became chair. So I had, I guess, was it 6 years? Does that sound right?
Yeah, I think it was 6 years plus if you count past chair as
well. Right. And then another year of all those phone calls as the immediate past chair or past chair. And so it was, I guess it was 7 years of EC officer level positions. And that, I tell you, the monthly phone calls, if anyone's listening who does not know that the officers, maybe they still do, but for all my years, we did a monthly call to make sure everybody was on the straight and narrow. And so I had 7 years of those calls. When it was over, I was just real happy to to not have that monthly call.
I think the second place position behind you is Nick Shaneen, who, now I'm getting into more recent history, but Nick served 2 years in the same position, I think, Secretary Treasurer, so that we could bring Judge Chris Altenburn into the leadership structure. And that's a story for another day. But yeah, I think that your 7 years will probably stand for a while.
Well, it was good, though, because it gave me a lot of time with the section. And in that time, the section really changed. I mean, it really grew. I mean, not because of me, just because that's what happened. We were maturing as an organization or a section of the bar. And we were really, it's fair to say, in a sort of a second generation of leadership, which was nice. And to some extent, I'd say now we're probably out of that, because that was more of a transition period, I'd say. And today it's a much more developed, sophisticated organization than it was during my years.
You know, I have to admit, this is the fourth in the series of these APS history interviews, but now I'm starting to feel old, because I was pretty involved in the section of the time that you were in the leadership and chair. I remember your time as chair very well. So, you know, now I'm starting to realize that was over 10 years ago.
Yes, it was.
So, yeah, I tend to describe these as the middle years, because I think you and I hadn't talked about this, but I agree that there was sort of the section was out of its early phases, but it was still maturing, you know, coming into what it is today. Now it feels like it's a very established, you know, sort of well-oiled machine, but we were kind of still learning the ropes and figuring out how this thing was going to go and building the model that persists.
Well, and let me speak to those earliest years of my involvement at the officer level, because as someone who either attended EC meetings or even as somebody who had just gotten on to the EC, I didn't appreciate very much about how the section ran, how decisions got made, what the sort of highs and lows were of everything, and especially on the finances side, I really didn't appreciate much. Then I became treasurer, and it was really alarming. This is back in, say, 2000, I want to say 6 or so, that I vivid recollections that we had a budget that was maybe 40 or 50,000 a year or so in you know, total budget expenses. And that's all we had in reserves. And, you know, as an accounting matter, you really don't want to have less in the bank than your annual spend, because all you need is one bad year and the whole organization goes kaput. And so that was probably the most important feature or concern of the section and section stuff in those sort of early years for me as an officer. was we didn't have any money. In fact, I think it was my first year, we lost money. Like we were going, we may have gone 2 years in a row where we lost money. It was at least one, but it may have been two, where we, and the numbers were small back then. You know, I remember the CLE, total CLE revenue that we budgeted, you know, may have been 12 grand or 14 grand, just very modest amounts compared to, you know, where things later went. And so we had massive discussions about how to make money. You know, at one point, I think I wrote a memo to all the officers and maybe to others too, and like the multi-point plan to start raising revenues. And we had to increase section dues, and we started like the telephonic monthly series and charged for it, which was a thing. Although we anticipated it would be a bit of a loss leader, because at the time we were thinking we wouldn't charge as much as it would cost. Turned out we ended up making money on the whole thing. And I forget the other couple things, but oh, I know, it was the dessert reception. We had decided to put a huge emphasis on sponsorships because, you know, given where the money was at the time, you could, with a little bit of hustling in trying to get firms and others to sponsor the dessert reception, you could get as much money from that as we made from CLE over the year. And so it was a huge push to increase. And that's sort of where we came up with these categories of sponsorship. And we tried to, you know, sort of flesh out the details of if you're at this level, we'll give you this thing and this recognition and that recognition. And all that was just in an effort to increase revenues because we really needed it. At any rate, that was the dominant focus of things. We used to have the EC meetings. For anyone who does not remember those days, I will share that compared to today, it would just seem so strange that the meetings back then, most of the discussions focused around money. Everything we did was, well, can we afford that? Can we do it? Is there how do we pay for it? A couple years into my officer stint, or maybe it was early years, I forget. But I remember every year we had discussions about, like the Appellate Court Rules Committee wanted us to help sponsor their microphones or something. And, you know, they wanted $250. And we had like a 30-minute discussion during an EC meeting over whether we could spend $250 on the ACRC mics. Just mind-boggling, compared to today and how things are. And the same happened with the high school moot court competition. You know, wanted $500 or $1,000, and it was a free-for-all of folks grabbing the mic and talking at the EC meetings over how either responsible or irresponsible it was to be spending money we didn't have, or how could we get it. And, you know, of course, then you had, it's in our mission, it's right in line, how can we not? This is, you know, the perfect opportunity. This is why we're here, kind of positions. And it just dominated a lot of things. Over the course of time, things just improved. And we were good with how we spent what we had. And the big change really came when CLE started to shift from being predominantly live to being, I won't say predominantly viewed on video, but just that once that became a real meaningful option, especially to watch over the internet, the sort of on demand, that didn't exist back when, you know, my early years. I'm not even sure it existed in my last year as chair, although it probably was starting about then. And that really changed everything.
Yeah, and I think, you know, looking at things from today's perspective, we think, oh, you know, COVID changed the world to video, but that wasn't the case. I mean, the video revolution for CLE started a lot earlier than that.
And years earlier than COVID. Yeah. COVID certainly had an impact. You had lots of people with time on their hands and no opportunity to get out and do things, and it was something you could click on and watch or be part of. But no, that as soon as those became available, and I always assumed that we were helped because of our spelling, the appellate section is an A. So when you go to the bar and click on the CLE link and start looking at sections and programs, the appellate is kind of high on the list, and you could click through and start to find all kinds of programs. And to some extent, our stuff sounds interesting. We really had one of the big CLE focuses in my time. And I guess looking back, I was CLE chair before I was an officer. So I'm not even sure how that happened, but I was CLE. I went to enough meetings that somebody, actually I think it was Tom Hall, somebody said, you ought to be CLE chair. And so poof, I became CLE chair. And one of the focuses that we had, and I think kept going forward, was we had to make the names of our programs more attractive, especially to non-appellate people. Because, you know, you could say preservation of error to an appellate person, and that might sound interesting. But you can't say that to anyone who's not an appellate person and expect that to sound interesting. They think that sounds like a horrible thing to talk about for any amount of time. So we worked really hard on rejiggering the program names and to some extent what we called the segments within the programs to make sure they sounded more cool to somebody who wasn't necessarily an appellate geek.
No, that makes sense. I hadn't thought about that. More focus on marketing.
Exactly.
To the wide audience.
Exactly.
I remember back in the days that you were just talking about, you know, when they did the treasurer's report in the beginning of the meeting, everybody sort of hung on every word to see how much money we had, which doesn't happen anymore. And I hadn't thought about the fact, you know, the dessert reception, that sort of thing, the sponsorships, of course. You had mentioned the membership fees, the dues that we pay the bar. That's there, but it's kind of a small component. CLE has just been the driving force in more recent years of the revenue of the section.
Well, yeah, and you can't overstate that. Rewind back to my earliest years, those numbers were fairly close to even. I mean, how much we generated from dues, how much we generated from CLE, and how much we generated from the dessert reception. It was sort of a triple there. And now there's no comparison. We make an awful lot of money off CLE, and the other items are, you know, negligible by comparison. And that's just how much things have changed.
And anybody who knows you, Matt, and has heard you speak at different meetings knows that you are a proponent of, you know, the section trying to seek some financial independence so that we're not necessarily tied to, you know, the bar sharing money with us from membership dues and that sort of thing. And this whole press with CLE has allowed us to get to a point where that's, if we haven't met the goal, we're at least, it's very realistic at this point.
Well, and I think to some extent, the goals have changed a little bit. There was in the 2000s, there was a sentiment that may or may not have been kind of earned that the sections might want to be a little uncertain about how friendly the bar was going to be with allowing the sections to kind of keep their money, because it's all the bar's money. I mean, we talk about it like it's our own, but it's the bar's money. We're part of the bar. We are the bar in a very real sense. And so a lot of this, you know, these are the section's finances as if we have our own accounts at a bank somewhere, and we don't. These are the bar's money. It's the bar's account, and it's managed by the bar. If it's managed well, it improves with the bar's investments. In the 2008-09 range, the bar lost money like almost every other investor on the planet did. And that took a hit on our numbers for us, just like it did for all the other sections with the bar. But there was for many years a recurring discussion about what it meant to be financially independent. And part of it was just having enough in reserves that we didn't have to worry And that was extremely important to a number of people. But then there was another set of folks who were really interested in breaking away from the bar. And for a number of years, that was a recurring topic about, well, what if we created our own company and put the money in the company? And then we wouldn't sort of have to work with the bar and all of its requirements and ways of the bar is, I'll make a bad analogy, but it kind of makes the point. The bar is kind of like the government. It finds a way to give you stuff and then take it back from you. Or worse, it allows you to find a way to make stuff on your own and then it takes it from you. And that's kind of the, you know, not to insult the bar, because I'm a big fan of the bar and I've been active member of the bar and whatnot these ways for decades now. But that is the way it works. And to some extent, it has to be that way because the bar needs to exist and we need to have administrators and you know, staff, people to answer phone calls, people to help us run meetings, people, all these people need to get paid. They need benefits. They need, you know, they need to have gainful employment, and that requires a staff and it requires a lot of money to make it happen. And of course, as we expanded into all sorts of additional tech and those things, you had to pay these people from the bar's end. So they needed money from the sections. And so for quite a while too, the bar was being more and more creative with, you know, how do we change the, and there's, all, I won't get into the details, but there's all kinds of ways the bar, a dollar comes into the section and it gets split with the bar all kinds of ways, depending on what the activity is. And when you really dig into the minutia of that, it can be a bit frustrating because it really, it's amazing how many ways the bar would do that. You know, but that said, I never blamed the bar and I don't think most people did. It was more of a, there was an independence streak that some folks had that was pretty significant. I think that fervor has died down mostly because at this point, the section's finances are so substantial that there's not a concern.
Yeah, I still hear some of those sentiments a little bit, you know, a little bit of, you know, maybe distrust that the bar will take some of our money. But, you know, I think
Word sweep used to get used a lot.
and as of yet, you know, we have yet to see anything from that. And like you said, we have this weird symbiotic relationship with the bar, right? They can't exist without us to some extent. We certainly can't exist without them. And they're a part of this big CLE machine that funds us. You know, we couldn't do it without them. They're the entity that accredits the CLE and requires it and that sort of thing. So whether we like it or not, we're a bit of a cog in the wheel.
We are, and we're a good cog though. And we, at this point, we're a respectable section. We have a respectable membership level. And as far as our reserves go, we're in really good shape and the bar wouldn't want to lose us.
I wanted to jump back to something we had talked about before about Justice Quintero, Raul Quintero, when he left the Florida Supreme Court and came back to his involvement in the section. That was really the first instance of someone who was on the court or a judge or justice, period, joining the leadership of the section, right?
Yeah, and what he did was really extraordinary in helping the section mature as it has, because, and I'll just say Raul, because Raul is a friend, and I don't mean any disrespect in not saying Justice Quintero. It did take me a while to not call him Justice Quintero, yes. but he would be the first to say, call me Raul.
Yes.
And it was wonderful for the section to have him come off the court and step back into leadership, because he was very willing to pick up the phone and call not just the Supreme Court justices, but to call the DCA judges and to say, are you interested? Would you be interested in helping us do this or helping us do that? And that opened a lot of doors for us that wouldn't otherwise, I think, have been opened. Raul was a wonderful sort of bridge between the section and the judiciary in a way that we just hadn't had before. And what he did in his first couple years back with the section after leaving the court led to tremendous changes. And in some respects, I don't want to call them partnerships because that's the wrong word, but opportunities maybe is the better word to interact with the courts in ways we hadn't before. You know, the DCA Judges Conference just being one example of that. And all of that was because of Raul. He had a credibility and a relationship and a friendship with people in those positions that us, you know, normal folks just didn't have.
And it's always been one of the hallmarks of the section in more recent years is a great relationship with the judiciary. And so I think it's important to remember sort of, you know, how that started and that we keep up that relationship. And now, you know, our past chair, Judge Wozniak, so we have another judge in the leadership chain. I think it helps, you know, it just helps validate the section from a judicial perspective and helps encourage that involvement that is good for everybody.
Well, I'll suggest something that I don't know if it gets put this way or if it gets put this way often enough, but the more the judiciary is involved with our section, the more people want to be a part of the section. And the more people want to be a part of the section, the better you make the appellate bar in this state. Because you become more collegial. You become, I've done this now for decades. The difference between a case where I look across the V and see an appellate specialist counterpart compared to a case where that's not what's happening is night and day sometimes. And a lot of that is because once you put yourself into this community, this professional group, I think you internalize a lot of values that folks otherwise might not internalize. And it so the judges are a draw to the practitioners becoming a better group of lawyers. And because of that, our practice in front of these judges, I think, is elevated and is better. So there's a real benefit to the judiciary from its involvement with our section. It actually improves our section and ultimately, I think, impacts the way the section practices in front of the courts. And that's just a wonderful positive. You can't possibly overstate how significant it is.
I agree. It's a huge asset, and it's a huge part of why the section is what it is today. Before we wrap up, I wanted to talk to you a little bit about the 11th Circuit Appellate Practice Institute that we affectionately call ECAPI, because I know that you were involved in getting the section involved with that. And it's becomes, I guess we had some years off because of COVID and that sort of thing, but it's become a real staple of the section, our involvement with ECAPI. Can you talk a little bit about how that started?
Sure. It started with a wonderful attorney who at the time was with the U.S. Attorney's Office in Georgia, named Amy Weil. And Amy was very interested in putting together a conference that would focus on the 11th Circuit. And so she reached out to the appellate section leaders in Georgia, Alabama, and Florida, and basically said, I'd like to put together a conference. If you would like to help me, let me know. And at the time, Tom Hall was our chair and the section's chair, and I was the CLE chair. And so Tom and I said, well, this is actually a really good idea if we can make it happen. It's something the section had tried. We had, before I was CLE chair, we had tried to put together an 11th Circuit focused CLE, and we couldn't do it. We just couldn't do it. To pull it off, you have got to have the ear of a lot of people in Atlanta. And we didn't, which I'm sure is why we just couldn't pull it off. And so when Amy reached out, I remember I got on a plane and we flew up to Atlanta. I met Tom up there, and we were like the Florida contingent. And there was a small group from the Georgia appellate section, a small group from the Alabama appellate section, and then us. And we just started brainstorming about how to put together a CLE that would involve the court. And it was really interesting how it came together. We had, I'll say early on, as we raised the idea with the court, we got a fairly mild response about the court's participation because, you know, they're busy. They have a lot going on. And so we started trying to understand, well, what can we do that will make it easier on the court, more attractive to the court? And we ended up putting together a program in Atlanta during their embank week so that in all likelihood, they would all already be in Atlanta. It was much less of an ask to say, hey, you're already in town. Would you mind coming over to participate in this program for a segment or two? And then the real coup was there was an attorney on our original planning committee named Teresa Roseborough, who had a relationship with Justice Thomas. Justice Thomas is our circuit justice. And Teresa was able to reach out to him and persuade him to be our original keynote speaker. And as soon as that happened, everything fell into place with, wow, we got Justice Thomas coming and it's all going to be wonderful. And it was. We put on this multi-day conference in Atlanta and it was just fantastic. And that was in 2006. I guess those first meetings were 2005, going into 2006. The fall of 2006 would have been the first ECAPI. And then a year or two, and it was a strange program because we wanted to do it again. We knew that doing it the next year was not a good idea. We thought, well, should it go 2 years? Should it go 3 years? I think the first time we went 2 years. And so I think the second ECAPI was 2008, also in Atlanta, also with Justice Thomas as the keynote. And again, it was a great program. And by that time, we learned a lot from doing it the first time, especially on the financial side of it. There's a huge administrative side to putting on any program. It doesn't matter where you are. Atlanta is no different. And originally, ECAPI was done working with the Georgia CLE folks with ICLE Georgia. We used them to put on the whole thing, and they were ecstatic to do it. And I think they, financially, it worked out. The group that did it was just a bunch of lawyers who came together to want to do it. I mean, in a sense, we each represented the sections that we came from. And so in a very informal sense, the appellate practice sections of the Georgia, Florida, Alabama bars are who have created this. But there's never, to this day, there's never been, and we're coming up on almost 20 years later, there's never been a structure to ECAPI, which is something Amy is currently trying to correct. But we've, in almost 20 years, we've never been able to correct it. Structure, I mean, in the sense there's no company. There's no ECAPI is not like incorporated or something. It's just the truth is we came up with the name sitting around a table in Atlanta at one of those planning meetings where we almost worked backwards. We wanted to come up with something you could say as an acronym, and then we kind of filled in what could it mean. You know, it's like these legislative acts where the act acronym matches exactly like the purpose of the act.
Right.
But not quite that bad. But we were like playing with 11th Circuit and something, something, something till we finally found something you could pronounce. And that's how it became 11th Circuit Appellate Practice Institute. We found ECAPI and then worked backwards into Appellate Practice Institute because you could say it.
Right.
One of the things we wanted to have was we wanted to be able to pronounce this thing with a shorthand acronym. And anyway, on the topic of organization, though, we did it in 2000, 6, 8, and 10 in Atlanta and through ICLE each time. After three times in Atlanta, Atlanta was kind of burned out on ECAPI. The attendance kept dropping. And so we said, all right, time to move. And I volunteered to bring the program to Florida. And so we went through the what was really crazy time of trying to organize ECAPI in Miami. And it was an extraordinary challenge because the court does not travel regularly for its embank weeks. It can. In fact, we were having discussions with them about it, except they, I'm not sure how it works today, but at the time the court would consider traveling for an embank week if it had an embank case from that place that needed to be argued. And so when we were talking to them about how to put together ECAPI in Miami, the big question was, will there be an embank case out of Florida that could be argued in Miami? Because if there was a chance we could get the court to come bring all the judges to Miami, which would make the whole pro, you know, if they're all there, it's so much easier to ask, would you participate in this? If they're not there, now it's a whole different deal. You're asking people to get on a plane, travel, stay in hotels just for you and your program. And we didn't have any money. We didn't, you know, we weren't really expecting to reimburse everybody for these things. And it was a huge challenge. And at one point, the Miami ECAPI was dual tracked. We started to build a date and an agenda around if there was going to be an embank week in Miami. And then we created an alternate universe where if there wasn't going to be an embank week, how else could we pull it off? And they weren't sure about the embank week until I think it was 6 weeks before or 8 weeks, it was some rather small amount of time before. And as it turned out in 2012, there was no embank week in Miami. It was in Atlanta. And so we had to go to the plan B. And then the plan B turned out to be really hard to put together in what was then just a couple months' notice because we were trying to build out that whole faculty again, including the judges coming and all kinds of things. And it came together about 5 weeks before the program was supposed to happen. And I remember the bar calling me up after this got to some senior level at the bar where somebody figured out that the appellate section was putting together a seminar with 40 speakers and it was going to be in 6 weeks. And the bar was saying, oh, and we got all dreamy and ambitious with how we do it. We're going to rent facilities at Miami-Dade community, wasn't community, Miami-Dade College. And we somehow, I think it was Amy. I think Amy Weil talked to Judge Barquette at one point and said, we would love if we can bring this program to Miami, if you would help us with some kind of a hosting event in Miami. And somehow in a moment of weakness, Judge Barquette said something about, sure, you can all come to my house. And that was, I'm sure there was a significant delay between when that probably not entirely serious conversation happened and when I later called up Judge Barquette like 6 weeks before this program was supposed to happen and said, Judge, I don't know if you remember me, but we've met once or twice and I'm just being friendly here, but you may recall once saying to Amy that if we did the ECAPI program in Miami, that you would kind of host an evening or so. And she said, I what? And it was pretty extraordinary. She smiled through it and said, you know what? Let's do it. And we ended up coming up with all these plans about how to have an event at Judge Barquette's home. She's like, well, but you can't come in. I'm not going to have, she said, how many people are you going to have? I said, well, hopefully like 150 or more. And she said, well, I can't have 150 people in my house. Let's just do it on the lawn and whatnot. I said, all right. So then she said, well, I don't want you coming in to use my bathroom. So we're going to need to like rent facilities. And so we did. All these things happened. We put together this. We ended up getting like these nice motor coach buses to take everyone who attended ECAPI out to Judge Barquette's home on the evening between the 2 days. and the place was wonderful. She's a beautiful home. And we set it up nice with catering and the comfort stations that we rented that were very first class, by the way. And the whole thing was incredible. I mean, the judges came, all the attendees, a lot of the attendees came. It was kind of a feature of coming to the program was you got to go to this thing at Judge Marquette's house. It was super cool. And anyway, so the whole Miami thing happened. And then the next time Ecappy went to Alabama, we did it in Montgomery. And then that was the third state. So now it was a different administrative approach to how to organize it, how to handle it. You know, the state bar folks in Alabama did the administrative side of it. And that was something. It was a really extraordinary event. If anybody remembers going to that or being involved with that, you had, I think it was Judge Joe Flo. The event we planned for the night in between was a local baseball game for a minor league team that was there in Montgomery. And Judge Joe Flat, like, threw the first pitch or so and then came up to where all of our folks were and kind of regaled us with stories for a little while. And it was just another neat event. And now that was, 2014 or 15 or thereabouts. And
I was there for that one. It was a Montgomery Biscuits game.
Biscuits. Yeah, you're right. That was it. I think I still have the hat somewhere because I bought
a hat.
The hat
was cool. It's like their logo is like, their mascot is like a pat of butter on a biscuit or something.
it's a great logo. I saw the hat and thought, I have to get one of these hats. It's just too cool.
All right. I was just going to wrap up, Matt, unless is there anything else that we should talk about that we didn't?
I will not have anything important to add, but I will say that the section is extraordinary. I'm really honored to have had the opportunity to be part of that leadership for a time. I do agree with your characterization that my years were, from today's perspective, kind of the middle years in some ways, where we really did grow as a section and mature into what we've become. How about this? One thing we did not talk about in terms of maturity, but I'll throw it out there because I really should. When in all of my years, from 2006 to 12 or thereabouts in the leadership meeting the officer positions, I don't know that we had any internal operating procedures or other written protocols for anything. And that's just part of the life of an organization, right? The organization begins and everybody's kind of freewheeling it. And then you have kind of a point where you settle into your identity and you figure out what you're doing and you start to do it and you even start to do it pretty well. And then you get to a later stage where you know who you are, you know what you're doing and what you want to do. And this new blood comes in and says, I can't believe you fools haven't written all this stuff down. And so all of a sudden you get this big push to formalize everything. Oh, we do this way, and we do this way, we do this way. And so that was sort of the next stage in the section. And it's great to see because none of that was there when I was there. And we were fumbling our way still, but we were finding our identity. And now the section really has it, and it's under just great leadership. And there's so many positions in leadership now. If you want to become involved in the section, there is no excuse not to, and no lack of opportunity, because there are so many leadership positions, not just as the officers, but all the different chairs. We've got chairs, and the chairs have vice chairs, and it's just amazing. There's so many opportunities. So I thank you for the opportunity to chat about all this. I hope anyone who listens, if you've not been involved in the section, that you do your best to get involved. It's a great place and a great organization.
Thanks, Matt. As always, when I'm wrapping these things up, I can think of so many other things. We can only scratch the surface, but I think these interviews give people a great perspective and going into the future of, just sort of what it was like in this case, some of the middle years, we'll call them, of the section. I really appreciate your time and your participation in the project. Thanks for being here.
You're most welcome.
This oral history project was commissioned by the Appellate Practice Section in 2023 to to record the history of the section as part of its 30th anniversary. Thank you for listening.